Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe, and this week's Ryan, Justin, again, because this is the second half of the episode which we split in half a few weeks ago. And for those of you who are just joining us for the first time, a leisure list is when we do a potpourri of entertainment reviews, non-spoiler. Could be novels, video games, TV, movies, audio dramas, from basically any decade. Imagine it could be here. And by nobody's special request, I'm going to try putting a list of the reviews in the description, just in case you're looking for something specific. Maybe time codes as well, if time allows. But let's get into the episode now, get into our close-up, and continue where we left off. So, we also watched Star Trek IV, continuing on with that series. The one with the whales. I love this one. This one is just, it's just a comedy at this point. I mean, it's not like an outright comedy, especially not in the first act. The first act's pretty serious about Earth's basically being destroyed and the Enterprise crew has to go back in time to the 1980s to basically take a specimen of this alien species that is extinct in the future. And it turns out to be whales. So the entire movie is just a fish out of water comedy of the Enterprise crew having to go around 1980s, I think it's Los Angeles, or was it Seattle? It was somewhere on the West Coast, I think. So they have to just basically absorb 1980s culture and not seem like such weirdos with their future knowledge and behaviors the way they are. Just being a total contrast with modern day. And this is another one I respect for being, I'd imagine, pretty low budget, considering it's a Star Trek movie that mostly took place in the time they filmed it, the time in rough region the movie would have been filmed. There wasn't a heck of a lot of action or set pieces or crazy like ship designs and models and spacefaring things going on in this movie. No, it was pretty stripped back. It was mostly down to the writing on this one and just this cast of people who have a good chemistry after working together for 20 years, just riffing off each other for a couple hours. It's quotable, good fun, the perfect amount of absurd. The actors have great comedic timing. I think Star Trek IV is a must-see. And it's got an ahead-of-its-time environmental message as well. Don't mess with the environment too much or it'll bite. It'll come back in the future and haunt us. I don't think they were really talking about overhunting of whales a heck of a lot in the mid-80s. So this movie was ahead of its time for social messaging, as was most of Star Trek.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. It was very interesting how each movie slowly shifted genres, and this one was,
yeah.
You know, you've got the same actors who've played something really serious, and then you go into something, and you still believe that these are the same characters because they don't take. It's like they don't take our time period as very serious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because like the stakes are so low when it's just an Earth-based type thing, right? But when you get to Star Trek time, where it's all, you know, they're dealing with alien races and all sorts of stuff, that it's a lot more serious to them. So they don't take
yeah,
you know, Earth's little politic things so serious.
One of my favorite bits,
really fun movie.
One of my favorite sequences, just thinking about that out of context thing, is like Chekhov just wandering around asking people where the nuclear submarines are stored. This Russian guy in the 80s is like in the middle of the Cold War is walking around asking where U.S. military assets are being located. Like just stuff like that. And he doesn't even think twice about it because he forgets the time and place he's in, I guess. But it's just funny. It's just lighthearted fun. I guess I was going on a bit of a kick of like strong female protagonists in August because after Devil Wears Prada and Juno, I also watched Legally Blonde. And that one was easily one of the best feminist movies I've seen in a long time because it handles its protagonist fundamentally different to how modern movies do it. Where newer cinema seems to posit that the ideal woman is effectively a man in behavior, ambition, problem solving, sometimes in interests. So I appreciate Legally Blonde for asserting that a woman can be interested in traditionally female hobbies, wear bright pink, not take themselves too seriously, yet still be intelligent and competent. Personally, this kind of character is actually a strong protagonist, where the other is a strong male protagonist, which some executive or creative decided to turn into a woman just by virtue of having an actress play them. Like one to me is a woman who's well-written, and the other was probably a man in the first draft. Know what I'm saying? And then somebody's like, oh, well, what if a woman was the lead instead? Oh, okay, well, nothing on paper is going to change. Like, men and women are just different. It's, like, can't pretend otherwise. There's a lot of room for nuance, obviously, but I like Legally Blonde for saying, okay, but why do I have to downplay traditionally female things to be taken seriously? I can be a good lawyer and wear bright pink. What's wrong with that? And it's a pretty simple message, but it's one that's surprisingly lacking in today's quote unquote progressive environment. So that one was pretty darn good for sure. Another show I watched was Boardwalk Empire season 1, which shocked me when I saw that it was produced by Martin Scorsese and the first episode was actually directed by him. I'm like, wow, Scorsese did a TV show? Nice. I thought this was just a gangster show. The actors in the show are the main selling point. Steve Buscemi is incredible as the lead, Nucky Thompson, who is running booze in Prohibition era Atlanta, while Michael Shannon's FBI character is investigating him and trying to take down his boardwalk empire. He's on the Atlanta boardwalk. That's where Nucky at the Ritz-Carlton. That's where Nucky Thompson is based out of. And they have different gangsters from the era. I don't know how many of them are based on real people, but like Al Capone is in the show as a character by name. He's just Al Capone. I don't know how close that was mirroring his actual real life story, but yeah, seeing stuff like it's a good era. The production values are very high. It's well shot, well filmed, well acted. The story is well written too on the whole, but episode to episode, I found it was kind of repetitive sometimes. Some of the characters frustrated me. Margaret specifically is frustratingly naive, even though I think that's how the show wants you to feel, but it was played a little too much. some bits were just a little boring. I hear the show gets better going forward, but like there's a lot, there's a basis for something very good here. And I hear it did get really good going forward, so I'll continue with it. But season one was still worth a watch. What's next?
Okay, so I've got another audiobook. It was called Gideon the Ninth, and this one was very surprising. I'd never heard of it before. I tried it on a whim. It was a female author and two female protagonists, and I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about that, just because, you know, not a lot of dynamic when you have two female protagonists and a female author writing both. I wasn't sure how that was going to go. And I was very surprised because one of the leads was Gideon, and she was very interesting. She had a bit of a mouth on her, and she was a very well-written character who sort of acted more like a boy, but not really at the same time. So the whole thing set, it's a whole universe of necromancers, and there's nine planets, and you know, the other girl is the leader of the house, and she's the necromancer, and Gideon is her knight, and Gideon is like, she's a tough girl, like she's really cool. But so they basically take these two that they're paired up, and they're not really friends, and they go with all the other houses to this meeting place, which turns into sort of like a murder mystery type thing, slash kind of a trick house in a way. It was really interesting, though. It was very cool. I highly recommend it. And I'm definitely going to read the next one afterwards.
Nice. Looking forward to hearing about that. Another Star Trek here. The Final Frontier. Also known as the worst Star Trek movie in the franchise, by general opinion. And it's a bit of a toss-up for me whether this one is worse than the motion picture. I think it's one of those situations where the motion picture, I think, is a better movie overall, but that one was just pretty boring. Star Trek V is generally entertaining, even if it's not the best made. I've heard there were a lot of problems on the production where their budgets got slashed and Shatner couldn't do near as much as he wanted for his first time in the director's chair, first and only time in the movie series. But personally, he gets a bad rap, but I think his directing was ahead of its time. For a movie in the mid to late 80s, the way he directed the camera work was pretty reminiscent of modern cinema. I didn't really see a heck of a lot of camera work like that in old movies. Just the things he was doing with that were more modern than I was expecting. So I thought the camera work was very well done. Some of the gags are great as well. The rocket boots one, that was a good callback. That was a funny one. The villain, Sarek, he's awesome too. I like his portrayal, and he's interesting because he's not really that bad a guy. He's just trying to find God, basically, or whatever's at the center of the universe. He feels like a divine purpose is calling to him at the center of the universe, and he needs to get there. And he's got this ability to influence other people to his cause, sort of mentally manipulate them. But he's not out for a world domination sort of thing. He does bad things for what he sees are ultimately good ends. So, and also, as I was talking about before with Cobra Kai, I'm generally not a fan of retconning backstories to things, and Star Trek V is one of those examples where, okay, so you're retconning the world's history where, okay, fine, you're just going to pretend like this was always a thing and somehow nobody else knew about it. Wow, we're only finding out about this now. But whatever, they made it a canon thing and got to live with it. And it's fine. It worked for the movie. The effects work was a downgrade on this one as well. You can definitely tell their budget was lesser than the last couple movies. I think Wrath of Khan seemed to peak budget-wise, or the first one even, seemed to peak budget-wise, and they just got lower budget as the movies went on. Not that the effects were ever awful, but it was definitely worse in this one. The plot never really coalesces either, and some of the humor is overwrought, but it's good if you turn your brain off. What do you think of Star Trek V?
No, it's good. I don't think it was as bad as everybody says. I think it was pretty good.
No.
I laughed at it. It was good.
Hearing Kirk, Spock, and McCoy sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat is iconic. Mm.
Yeah, actually, I like that one a lot, actually.
This is the Trios movie. This is probably the movie that uses Kirk, Spock, and McCoy as the core trio of the original series to their best dynamic together. They're sort of the heart and soul as the three of them in this movie. And I think that's to its benefit and also detriment, because the other ones were finally starting to bring the other supporting cast into more prominent roles. You got finally more lines for Chekov, Uhura, Sulu, Scotty, and then they're sort of backseated again on this one for Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. But, you know, I love those three, so what can I say? And then after that, we watched Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which is awesome. I think this one's a must-see. I love pretty much everything about this one, except maybe the pacing a little bit in the second act might drag on rewatch. But not really the first time, but I could just see, all right, maybe it wouldn't be perfect if I were to look at it again. But I love Nicholas Meyer's directorial style. Just the visuals he creates are striking and just look good framed as stills, even. The lighting, the sets, the plot is what I most fondly remember from this film as how refreshingly nuanced it is. And I think it hits even harder at the time it came out because the Soviet Union had just collapsed and Star Trek always paralleled real world events. But the Klingon Empire in the original series was effectively the stand-in for the Soviet Empire, where they were Starfleet's biggest threat. And we've seen them throughout the original series and the movies fight Klingons time and time again. We've seen, for people who watched this movie when it came out, you've seen Captain Kirk fight Klingons for 20 years. So now there's a chance for peace with the Klingon Empire. And Captain Kirk isn't really buying it. You kind of see his perspective of, no, these are pretty brutish people who I don't think we can maintain a peace with. Their empire's on the verge of collapse, and I think we should, we should be the straw that breaks the camel's back. What are we doing suing for peace for? They're animals. And then the more cool heads are saying, look, it's Starfleet's thing to be diplomatic and peaceful, and we're not looking for a war here, even if we can win it. But the way it's presented is you understand both sides to the point where when the peace talks start to break down and there's a clear elements of sabotage at play, you never really know what's going on until later on in it. You're like, I fully buy that people wanted, like, that Starfleet personnel would want to disrupt these talks. That an assassination attempt is not out of the realm of possibility. It's very... But the Klingons aren't, you know, suddenly good guys. They're also kind of pricks, too. And so you have these both sides who have hated each other for years and are being forced to form an alliance together now. And it's handled with a lot of depth. And says a lot about human nature and what will it take for us to be friends with our enemies? Can we be friends with people we've been warring with forever? And is peace possible? Or is it only possible if you believe in it hard enough and work through a lot of struggle to get there? Yeah. It's a nuanced look at prejudice, is mostly what it is. Yeah. Thoughts?
Well, yeah, I think I'm having a hard time remembering this one because we watched a lot of them back to back. I do remember after we watched it, I did say, I was like, I think this might be my favorite one.
It's either this one or Wrath of Khan. It's a toss-up. Yeah,
this one was pretty good, especially considering how things kind of dropped off in the ones between Wrath of Khan. Like, you know, the whale one was pretty good, but this was a return to form, kind of, and it was really, the politics was really well done in it.
The thing I appreciate about all these Star Trek movies is a retrospective, or at least for the original series cast, is they managed to get the feeling of the original series in that every installment could be a wildly different tone with different people, places, and things happening. And I'm used to movie franchises basically feeling the same with every entry. But Star Trek dared to feel like a TV, like a series of two-hour TV episodes where you could explore wholly different things. The first one is a very heady sci-fi movie about finding an object in deep space that's causing some troubles, and okay, we gotta go and investigate this to save the planet. The second one is a tense revenge thriller about a midlife crisis and legacy of what you've done throughout your life coming back to bite you. The third one is about a group of lifelong friends who are willing to break all manner of laws and go to the end of the universe to save their teammate and their brother, basically. And number four is a lighthearted environmental parable where they go around modern times and crack jokes, and it's like a situation comedy. It's just weird. Number five is a kind of going back to heady sci-fi with the nature of like religion versus science, or can they be in tandem, like the search for God in space. And then number six is a political thriller about warring factions trying to sue for peace amidst tense background of Losing my train of thought, but yeah, it's, they're all very different. And I appreciate that. So what you got?
So I got another audiobook, Red Rising. It's essentially everybody is classified by colors for the, you know, the top of society and the bottom of society. So the main character, Daryl, is a red. He's the bottom of society and basically kind of fakes his way into being a gold. At least that's the idea of the first book here. And it's interesting because it sort of falls into being kind of like a YA novel, but not really at the same time because it's so... The emotional maturity of Daryl is much higher because he's a red. He acts a lot older than he is, where they portray him as being like 18 in the book, but he's, you know, he has a wife, he has a hard job, he's thinking about retirement, he's, you know. And so following this character, when you take this more mature character and then stick him into a essentially like a Hunger Games type situation with the golds, and they're all immature, it's very interesting watching him fit into there. And, you know, some people say it's sort of like a YA novel, but it's also not at the same time. But it's pretty interesting, it's pretty good. I'll probably try the next one. I don't know, if it falls more YA again, I'm not sure if I would continue it. It's not that it's badly written. It's just, it started out really strong, and then sort of lost my interest when it went more, almost like a clone of Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Just not really into that, so we'll see. I'll see where the next one goes.
All right.
But it's cool.
I watched Twin Peaks, The Missing Pieces. After I finally got to see Fire Walk With Me, The Missing Pieces was a logical next step. Because it's effectively 2 hours of deleted scenes from Fire Walk With Me. It's not really cohesive. That's why you need to see Fire Walk With Me before you see The Missing Pieces, because they're either extended scenes from the movie or just stuff that was in between. But they add a whole lot to the lore of Twin Peaks. It's a lot of good stuff cut from the movie. But then again, that movie was disturbing enough without this stuff in there as well. Really, this is just for the fans. It's extra details if you want answers to some questions. Or if you just really like the characters and you want more time with them. Although, I will be talking about Twin Peaks The Return pretty soon. And I got to mention that some stuff from The Missing Pieces does have a bearing on The Return. So, once again, it's mostly for Twin Peaks completionists, but it does still count. It's worth a watch, definitely. I read another book. This one is called The Warsaw Protocol by Steve Barry. It's effectively about this information broker who has different people steal very prominent religious artifacts to buy their way into an auction where he's selling information, which is a blackmail for the president of Poland. All these people want access to the information so the president of Poland can be in their back pocket, because Poland's the site of a very strategic political talk right now. In the book, that is, between different powerful people and nations. So it's about this guy who was, I don't remember now if he's CIA or NSA or Secret Service maybe. His name's Cotton Malone, and he retired from this place, but he's just kind of hanging out in Europe when one of the artifacts gets stolen. And then one of his partners in the U.S. government is like, hey, want to help me out with this? He's like, yeah, sure. Why not, I guess. And they have to deal with these idiot representatives from the U.S. government. And that was one of the big problems with the book, I think, is how thinly veiled the commentary on Donald Trump's foreign policy was grading through. That's basically what the entire book is, well, a third of it, at least. Very different things, I suppose, a third in the entire book. But Cotton Malone and his partner are very constantly upset with the new president's aide, who's bungling their operation and just making the stupidest decisions possible, which reminded me a heck of a lot of Donald Trump's foreign policy, just the way he used to be as president. And the other parts of the book were more interesting because those digs at Trump's presidency just felt tired by now to me. And they repeat it a lot. I'm like, okay, I get it. The president, they think the president's an idiot and they can do better and just leave us to do our jobs and we'll get it done. All right, I get it. But the villain was cool though. The information broker who is trying to start this blackmail thing, and you find out pretty fast that he's way in over his head on this. He doesn't really anticipate the trouble he's bringing down on himself. And then there's also the president of Poland who's being blackmailed, and he's trying to find this information before it gets out to the auction. So it bounces back and forth between all these three characters throughout the book. You have the investigators, you have the spies looking for the blackmail, you have the blackmailer, and you have the president who's being blackmailed. It was well written. It was really cool. Lots of tense sequences. Good espionage drama. I quite enjoyed this one. Definitely worth a read. Next for you.
All right. So I'm going to go into some Japanese anime. I'm going to give you a tip on Japanese anime. If you're like me and you would prefer to listen to an English dub, the best way to find out if the English dub is good is just see if the dub matches the subtitles. If the English subtitles match the English dub, it's probably going to be pretty good. If it doesn't, then it's usually a third party has done the dub and it just doesn't. It's not near as good. So that's usually my rule of thumb for that stuff. So going into that, I watched Death Note, which, you know, I didn't have very much interest in it. You know, I kind of know the concept, whatever. You've got the notebook, you write people's names in it, they die. You know, it was, you know, like the supernatural type thing didn't really appeal to me. This show is more like two geniuses going head to head, but one is trying to catch the other and the other has the Death Note. And it's very well written. They're constantly going back and forth, and it's just a really, really interesting battle of wits. It's completely different to what I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. And it's totally up my alley, where I thought it really wasn't, and it was fantastic. It kind of dipped off at the end because they could only carry it so far, and then they kind of changed some characters out, and it started petering off to the end, but it still ended pretty well. It's definitely worth watching. It's really, really unique. I don't know if I've watched anything like that before. It's just very smart in how it's written.
Yeah, since hearing you talk about it, that's one I probably will give a try at some point. but I haven't caught the anime bug yet. I need to ease my way into that. It's a whole world of stuff. Yeah. So I read this book, The Earth and Sky and Marvels of Astronomy by Clarence R. Smith. It's 100 years old by this point. Well, maybe not quite that old, but it's pretty old. It's somewhere around that old. And you'd be surprised to see how much of it is still accurate to our astronomical understanding, despite a few facts that I'm aware of having changed. I just like seeing the comparison game as somebody who knows more than average about astronomy, getting to read this really old book and seeing, oh, well, that's still true. And yeah, okay, no, we've updated that and we've changed that, but nope, that's still true. And okay, yeah, like the scientific basis here seems pretty good for an old book. So just as an experiment there, I think I enjoy that just to see the difference. Yeah. I watched Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. I really enjoyed the first one as just a Tom Cruise action movie, kind of a investigative thriller sort of thing. It was cool, and I liked it. The second one is a pretty major downgrade. The dialogue is incredibly on the nose. The acting is wooden. The plot's predictable, it's poorly paced, and the action wasn't even that impressive. It's just... And it's also very self-serious, with a few bright spots of comedy to lighten the tension. So yeah, it made me smile a few times, made me chuckle. It's not completely devoid of entertainment value, but personally, don't bother. It's just, the first one's good. The second is a little bit of a waste of time. Doesn't ruin anything. It won't ruin your day, but yeah. Next up.
Okay. So I've got another anime. I've watched two seasons of Demon Slayer, which I believe the fourth season just came out. Like a week ago or so. So I'm working my way on catching up. What was really interesting with Demon Slayer, like, it's the whole concept is pretty unique. You know, they're kind of like samurai, specifically out to kill demons, but it's set in a more, it's kind of a funny blend between like an older period of time and then some of the cities are like newer style. I'm not exactly sure. I couldn't really place a time period for it. It's kind of interesting how it does that. But
I like things
what
like
I thought
that.
Was most unique was the second season, they did it in a movie form. So it was really well done. You can watch the movie, right? The movie came out in theaters and stuff, and I watched it like that. I didn't know that the second season of the show was essentially a clipped-up version of the movie. And I actually watched it both ways, because the movie is pretty fast-paced, so it was nice watching it through again. But having watched the first season, I always find the episodes are so short. I make fun of it when... I'm like, and it's like you get through the intro and then a little bit happens and then it's like it ends. I'm like, they've had three episodes where he's been fighting the same demon in the same fight. I'm like, wow, when, you know, it's just that the episode lengths are so short. So when it was presented in a movie format, they basically did the whole second season in one movie format. It was so well done. I wish, like, I hope that they do all the seasons like that. I know there's another season that's done that way. And I'm definitely going to watch it that way. It is nice watching it afterwards. Like, you know, I'm only half paying attention to it because I've already technically seen it. So we watched it pieced apart in the slower episodes. So, you know, but I thought it was really unique that they actually did it all as one and had it in both formats for whichever way you want to enjoy it. But it was, I really liked it in the movie format. I hope they continue doing that. But
cool.
Yeah, we'll see. There's one more. I'm working my way through season 3, and then I think it's season 4 that has another movie version.
Now this one is one I'd rave about for probably an entire episode if I got the chance. But Twin Peaks: The Return. It's amazing. It's the most unhinged and abstract art I've ever seen on a TV screen. It's a visionary director like David Lynch got free rein to make 18 hours of just pure weirdness. And Twin Peaks was already pretty weird. But then Fire Walk With Me pushed that envelope further. And The Return is just full-on weirdness. So I understand why a lot of people who watch the original have some problems with The Return. Because they don't even have really problems with the plot necessarily, but it just doesn't feel quite the same as the original in many ways. But that's also the point of it, really, is once that time and place has moved on, you can't really get it back. Some things are the same, for sure, but those things are often presented as kind of sad and pathetic. Like, wow, so much has changed in 25 years since the first one, and like, wow, we're kind of nostalgic for stuff, but the few things that actually stayed the same, you're like, really? That's still playing out the exact same way? Wow. You wish they could have grown up in 25 years. So he's sort of playing with the audience that way and your expectations of nostalgia. Most prominently with the character of Dale Cooper, who's one of my favorite protagonists of all time, played by Kyle MacLachlan, who gives a masterclass performance in this season as basically a mentally challenged guy in the body of Dale Cooper who Cooper just can't come out of this guy named Dougie. And you basically just see Dougie sleepwalk his way through life and fail upwards for most of the season when you just want to see Dale Cooper back. But then you sort of get invested in Dougie and whatever life he's building out where he is. And that bounces back and forth between Gordon Cole, who was played by David Lynch, and their investigation into weird stuff that's happening, into the evil Cooper. And then there's the stuff that's actually happening in Twin Peaks. So it's a very slow burn buildup with one episode in the middle that's basically, I'm going to tell you the plot of this because people say it's the best one, but we spend most of the episode. So it begins with a nuclear explosion, and we're just following the trails of the nuclear explosion, seeing all the atomic particles inside it. And then we see this weird creature who vomits stuff into the universe with a guy's head floating in a bubble. And then you see this other super tall guy. He also like vomits a bubble with another girl's face in it. And then the bubble gets sent down to planet Earth. And there's this weird bug thing that's crawling around. And like this teenage couple in the 1950s on a date. and people watch this and they're like, what the hell did I just spend an hour watching? And I watch, me and a bunch of other people watch that, and I'm like, holy crap, it's an origin story for the entire supernatural aspect of the universe. It's crazy. He just did an origin story. And like, it makes literally no sense. But that's also Twin Peaks in a nutshell. It's like, it makes perfect sense and no sense at the same time. So this is just 18 hours of pure weirdness, and it's like, watch ASAP. I love it. It's so good. It'll test your patience, but it's worth it. It's by design.
This it sounds so strange.
It's amazing. Once it's, I don't think you can just jump into The Return. You have to watch Twin Peaks, Season 1 and 2, Fire Walk With Me, The Missing Pieces. This is 25 years of story culminating. And also, fair warning, it doesn't end. It's like, there's an ending. But like, you'd think after 25 years, he'd finally resolve the cliffhanger from Season 2. And then he just ends on another cliffhanger, effectively. So, no, but you should have expected that. There's no real resolution. Even at the end of all of it. But it's still satisfying and tells a complete story at the same time. And I highly doubt we're getting any more, though. This was 7 years ago this came out, and most of the Twin Peaks cast is sadly deceased at this point. So, like, you could do more, but basically nobody's left to do it with. But I'd be curious to see them ever come back to Twin Peaks. I'm very satisfied with this. It's probably my favorite thing I've seen this year. All right. So first comic book here I got today is Batman Ghost Stories by James Tynion IV, Galen March, James Stucco, Carlo Pagulayan, and David Baron. And the rough plot of this one is, an old rival of Batman's comes to town and starts killing criminals and doing, taking down entire criminal operations. And he's just dismantling a whole lot of stuff around Gotham. And this is another element of rewriting backstories to things. So this story basically tries to say that, in all of Bruce Wayne's travels around the world when he was a teenager and learning all these tricks of the trade with various masters around the world, that there was another guy who was roughly his same age that he often ran into, who was kind of doing the same thing, but for different reasons. And they started off as friends and then sort of drifted apart when their motivations didn't line up anymore. And that's the ghost guy. That was pretty cool. That's a retcon that worked, because I haven't seen a heck of a lot of stuff that explores Bruce Wayne in his teenage years. So to say that there was a recurring character he had in those years, I bought into it well enough. The story gets a little dragged out in the middle, though, because most of the Bat family gets themselves into trouble and Batman has to figure out where they are and all that. Like, that bit was kind of dragged out. But the other stuff about this side character, this new supporting character called Clown Hunter, that was pretty interesting, because he's sort of an aftermath of the Joker's last big attack. He's just a random guy who, while all these Joker people, all these Joker goons were screwing around in his neighborhood, he starts killing all the clowns, basically. So he's this new vigilante on the scene who's trying to kill Harley Quinn, and Batman's got to try and rein this angry teenage boy in and be like, hey, I get it, but you could be a little bit more productive with this anger, maybe a little less homicidal. And so it's sort of all these things are happening. The Bat family's in danger. This Clown Hunter guy is in a vigilante rampage, and so is this ghost guy, and Batman sort of got to juggle all of it. It was interesting. Worth a read. I'm always a fan of James Tynion IV stories. You're up.
Okay. So I watched Dead Boy Detectives. It's terribly named, but that is a joke in the show, which makes it actually funny. The only reason I watched this was because it's part of the Sandman universe, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to give it a shot. I haven't heard anybody watch it. It's okay. I don't think I'm particularly the target audience, but also I'm not sure if it's for the target audience. I think it's for, because it's very mature. The language is pretty harsh. And also, I will say, I think the writing is pretty lazy. It, like, you want to show a character is angry, they just use the F word, like, every other word. And, yeah. Like, on shows like The Boys, you know, they're pretty, it's pretty vulgar. But the actors make it work. And, you know, it feels like it works. On this show, it feels like it's just lazy writing, and maybe better actors could have pulled it off. Somewhere along the line, somebody should have been like, I don't know if this is working. So also, you know, the language makes it seem like maybe it's not aimed at, like, I feel like the story is aimed at, like, maybe 15-year-olds or, like, you know, yeah, like, teenagers, but it's just really, yeah, it's just a funny mix, so I'm not sure who it's aimed at, and also, I don't think it's, like, that spectacular. It's okay. I mean, like, it's a, you know, put it on and eat a meal or something, and like, kind of half pay attention to it. So it's not terrible, but I don't know. I can't see myself watching another season of it. I'm sure there's better things to watch.
I'm going to combo my next two because I pretty much watched them back to back, which were Beetlejuice and Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. So the first one,
I did it.
Yeah. I put an and in the middle or something. Anyway, so the first one, I thought I knew what it was about, but apparently I really didn't, because I assumed it was mostly a story about Winona Ryder and Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice. Wasn't about them literally whatsoever, so I was wrong basically from scene one. I didn't even know Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis were in that movie, not let alone the protagonists of the first one. So I thought Beetlejuice was pretty darn good. Fun performances all around, dark humor that's right up my alley, great stop motion work and special effects. And I'm really liking the small scale movies too. Most of it's set in one house. And yeah, some of the acting was maybe a little bit weak, but it's also, well, Winona Ryder specifically, I'm going to call her out, but only because I'm going to praise her for the second one, because I think she's come a long way in 30 years. And that's very evidenced by watching the first and the second one back to back, is seeing how strong of an actress she's grown. Yeah, so the first one's just really fun and original all around. My favorite scene in the movie is when everybody's getting possessed at the dinner table to Deo, and they're just like, they're just dancing as the ghosts possess them. It's just so weird and unsettling, but comedic, because it's a song like Deo, and they're also kind of enjoying it, but they're horrified at the same time. It's just such a perfect blend of things and presented excellently, and that's the peak example of the whole movie sort of being like that sort of strange pocket of feelings. The second one, not as good as the first, but still worth a watch. It's a worthy follow-up. It does do that legacy sequel thing where it hits on a lot of the same beats as the first one, but I still think it's mostly doing its own thing. Not so much as an individual movie, I mean, but in terms of it's not a carbon copy of the first. It's still got that same sort of darkly comedic tone, except this time we see a lot more of the afterlife, underworld environment. And I thought it was interesting what they did with Winona Ryder's character, where she basically makes a career out of being somebody who can see ghosts. And half the people in her audience, even her own daughter included, played by Jenna Ortega, I think she's just this crazy lady who is making a show to con people who believe ghosts are real. But that's what she sort of made a name for herself on. But she also medicates herself to actually not see ghosts because she's just tired of seeing all these horrific things after 30 years. So then they have to go back to the house from the first one, and Beetlejuice gets released again and starts causing some troubles for people, and other things in the afterlife are starting to creep out. So it also keeps the focus on the family again, where I really like seeing Winona Ryder have to be Lydia, have to be a parent in this movie, because in the first one she had a lot of butting heads with her parents and her stepmother, specifically played by Catherine O'Hara. But in this movie, she and Catherine O'Hara have sort of mended their fences and become allies, and now it's Lydia's daughter who's causing her some grief, and they have a lot of tension as well. So just seeing those intergenerational dynamics, I enjoyed that. And it's also got fun and weird sequences. So, you know, Beetlejuice fan, and Michael Keaton's great in it for what time he's in it. The Monica Bellucci storyline and Willem Dafoe one just felt so completely removed and kind of useless. It just felt like it was from a different movie. It's just, but it's kind of, it's an original and unique movie and presentation in a way I haven't seen done in modern cinema in a while. This is Tim Burton doing a classic Tim Burton sort of thing. And it's a good feeling movie. What you got?
All right. So next up is another anime. It's Delicious in Dungeon. And I think you will want to watch this one. It's heavily D&D inspired.
Yeah.
It's essentially a massive dungeon. Basically, the whole party dies at the beginning, and they get sent to the top, but one of them is stuck behind. So they have to make their way through the whole dungeon to hopefully get her back. But the whole thing is like, oh man, we were distracted because we were hungry. We didn't bring enough food, so it's all about using the monsters in the dungeon as food. And it's despite the premise, it's very lighthearted. It's fun to watch. It's really cool. The characters are fun. And yeah, it's just neat watching something that's D&D inspired, and yeah, it's a good watch. I think you would really enjoy it. Yeah,
I probably will give that a shot. That sounds right up my alley for sure.
And
so getting
into it's got a very good English dub.
All right.
So you can watch it in English.
Nice. So we're getting into October now, scary movie season. I decided to watch some horror movies I'd never seen before. So, for a while, I watched Scream, which was excellent and groundbreaking at the time, I believe, for consciously subverting basically all the tropes of horror movies in the 20th century that had been built up over many, many decades. Some of them are played for laughs and dark humor just because of the situations that they're in. But most of them are played for just characters actually making smart choices. Sidney Prescott is maybe the best horror protagonist I've seen in a long time. If, like, she's probably one of the best ever, if not my favorite right now, just because of how resourceful she is. She is just a normal teenage girl, like you've seen a million times in other horror movies, except she feels more realistic because she's not an idiot. When Ghostface is coming at her, she'll kick him and run away. She'll, you know, lock the door. She won't isolate herself. She's kind of tactical sometimes. She, like, you know, she doesn't always win when Ghostface is trying to fight her, but she does make an active attempt to fight back and not be a victim. But she is dealing with guys who are, she's not an action hero. She's dealing with a guy who's more psychotic than her and stronger than her, and she's got to outthink her way out of the situation. So once again, this is another case of a strong female character from a different era, where modern movies, it's hard to have a damsel in distress sort of character who's not like beating up the monster or the bad guy with their bare hands. But Sidney Prescott's like, yeah, you know, she can throw a hit, but she's not really a physical match for these guys. So she still has to outthink them. So you do feel like, oh, she is vulnerable and in danger, but also I respect you as a protagonist and believe you can succeed. And I did know the twist going in, but not specifically the twist. And that's, I don't know how else to say that. I knew what the plot twist was, but I didn't really know the specifics of it. So I did have still some element of surprise in there for who the killer was. And I thought this film had very clever editing, playing with time and place to throw the audience for a loop with the twists. Great tension building and music. It subverted my expectations in all the right ways. Paced pretty well. Shot well. Good acting, good story. Good kills. Just solid all-around movie. Another horror movie I watched was Saw, the first one. See, this is another one where I find it funny. I watched two in a row like this, but this is another one where I knew the twist, but not the specific twist. So it still surprised me, where I'm like, I know what happens, but I don't know how it plays out exactly. So it was, I personally, when I was going into it, I thought the entire movie was just going to be Cary Elwes and the other guy just trapped in the room together. And that would just be the whole movie. No, but it was more. It was Danny Glover as the cop who's investigating Jigsaw and the kills that he's been making around town. So it's partially the investigation, but the movie was mostly in the pocket for me when it was the two guys in the room who are being pitted against each other by Jigsaw, and they're both chained up to they're both chained up to pipes in this room and have to deal with the resources around them, like stuff Jigsaw planted in their pockets or just out of reach or in the environment around them. They have to solve all the puzzles. And it's just a super psychologically complex story where, oh, and then when the more they uncover the puzzles, the more they uncover about each other. And they find out a lot about each other they don't like. And so it's sort of pitting them mentally against each other. And like, can they survive? Would they kill each other to survive? That's a big thing. Because the one guy is supposed to kill the other guy by 6 o'clock or something bad will happen. So it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to kill you. But can I be driven to kill you to stop the bad thing? So the entire thing is just breaking down these men psychologically just for the game of it. But it's also, the game does have a point. Basically, it's, can you push somebody to be a better version of themselves once you push them past their social breaking point? People who aren't grateful to be alive, if you can put them in a situation where they defy death, would they be more grateful to live? That's basically Jigsaw's method of operation. And most people fail the test. They don't want to live hard enough, so they don't. But would they be the people who could survive and thrive afterwards with a new lease on life? Well, that's the plot. I'm curious to see the sequels now, because I hear some of those are good too.
All right. So my next one, I re-listened to the first 4 Dune books, which all of them are pretty good. The big debate with Dune fans is whether 1 or 4 is the best. And a lot of people think the first one is the best. Personally, I think the 4th one is the best. And the next, I'm interested to see what Denis Villeneuve does with the next movie, because it's considered one of the weaker books in the series. So we'll see how that plays out. Also, listening to Children of Dune, which is the 3rd book in the series, which I never really liked it the first time, but the ending, it was basically felt like it was all build up, like really, really slow build up to a fast ending, which the ending was worth it. This time listening through it, I got a lot more out of it after having finished all of them, coming back around to the 3rd book once again. It was better than I remember. But the 2nd book is still probably the weakest one. So hopefully Denis Villeneuve will make some changes that will make it a little bit more interesting. Especially Timothy Chalamet as Paul, his performance is really impressive. So I think that will help carry it a little bit better, because he's such a good actor. So we'll see how that plays out. But hopefully they'll get through all of them and get to the 4th one, because that would be a spectacular movie.
Which is funny, because you said many, many times that the 4th will make a terrible movie.
Oh, yeah, it's a great book, it's really, really good, but it'll make a terrible movie. But I still want to see it, because they will find a way to make it into a good movie. But it will, as written, it would make a terrible movie, because nothing happens.
But it's the best one.
But it's arguably the best one, yes. It's my favorite one, for sure.
All right. Take your word for it. So I've recently finished The Shadow season 3, that old radio drama. So, the status quo is still changing in the Shadow Universe. We got a new supporting character in there by the name of Shweeby. And he's sort of this doofus personal driver of Lamont Cranston and Margot Lane, who's always... He's the comic relief character, really. I don't think he's played too annoying, although he sort of rides a line sometimes in these dark and brooding stories. But on the whole, I think he adds a pretty healthy dose of humor. But the show is also a lot funnier in general now because Lamont Cranston and Margot Lane have a lot more back and forth than they used to, which is all the more highlighted now that both of the main actors have been replaced. Agnes Moorehead's been replaced with Marjorie Anderson, and Orson Welles has been Bill Johnston for a while now. And I really like this pair. Bill Johnston and Marjorie Anderson they have good chemistry, just in audio. Together, their characters bounce back and forth off each other nicely. I really buy into this relationship. Marjorie Anderson is personally a better Margot Lane than Agnes Moorehead. Her delivery is more dynamic as this character, and I feel more for her. She's got more spunk, I'll say. Something about this version of the character I gravitate more towards. It's less flat. It's less one-dimensional. Not that Agnes Moorehead turned in a bad performance, but she was more... I don't know. I guess reserved is the word. I don't know. Marjorie Anderson plays Margot as a bit more carefree and lighthearted, and I just like that more. So, the other day... I watched Joker, Folie à Deux, and this one's getting slammed pretty hard, critically speaking. I have some defenses for it, but not enough time to get into that. But I'm going to sum up by saying it's an overly long and unnecessary epilogue to the first movie. That's really all it is. If you were a big fan of the first one, this is what happened after the fact for 2 hours, and it didn't need to be that long. But yeah, it's really only for super fans of the first one, or if you want to see another masterful Joaquin Phoenix performance, because he's still as good as ever. He doesn't phone it in. I love how Joker is a physical performance for him. As much as facial acting or delivery, he puts his whole body into this thing with every movement, his laughter, his face, his delivery. He plays Arthur Fleck and Joker nearly as two completely separate people. And you can tell just by his body language and the way he moves or the way he smokes a cigarette, who's in control. Not that it's a multiple personalities thing per se, although the movie does start floating that theory around. The musical aspect of this movie, which was widely talked about before release, I really, really wanted to like it, but it didn't work. The problem is that it's a half-assed musical. The big Broadway-style musicals where they just go for the fences and belt it out, that I can appreciate. All right. But these ones, like, where you're kind of half talking and singing at the same time, those ones, I'm like, no, they don't work for me. And that's a lot of what this one was, just talk singing. I'm like, with a couple of bigger set pieces that are reminiscent of classic Hollywood musicals. Some of those were okay. I really only liked one or two in the whole movie. They just didn't really add anything. They just took up screen time. This movie would have been quite a lot better off without them, because the story is actually sort of interesting for Arthur Fleck. I have to appreciate that this movie exists, though, because it was a big artistic swing. It was a swing and a miss, to reiterate, but the fact that it exists at all is a win for art. So I applaud it for trying. And I can also appreciate the gutsy commentary behind it, which, without getting into the plot, basically makes the audience of the movie complicit in Arthur's poor behavior. It turns us into the bad guys of Arthur Fleck's story, which, through its plot, the fact that we feel dissatisfied at the end is a reflection more on... Well, I mean, it's a reflection on the movie, but the movie intends it to be a reflection on us, which I think a lot of people are missing the point on that, but that doesn't make it enjoyable or satisfying. Anyway, what's next?
Okay, so I watched All Quiet on the Western Front, the German edition, the new one. I'm not sure when it came out. Couple of years ago,
2020
maybe
20 something, 2020. Yeah, some.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't that long ago. And it was all right. It was pretty good. It was visually, it was really good. All the camera work and everything, the cinematography is amazing. It's really good. My biggest problem with it is that it completely misses the mark of the original book. Maybe I'm not sure if that's a controversial opinion or not. I'm just speaking my mind.
Yeah.
I think it missed the entire purpose of the book.
I can't remember what I said about it on this podcast. I have talked about this movie on one of the Oscars roundup episodes whenever it was nominated for Oscars. And I did like it. At the time, for all the reasons you said, it looked great. It's well acted. It's, you know, I enjoy this modern trend of countries taking back their classic literature and adapting, like, hey, a German novel adopted by Germans, how novel. But, upon further reflection, it did miss the point.
Mm-hmm.
It left out multiple... All Quiet on the Western Front's one of my favorite books, and there were many key scenes that were left out. Without getting too far into it, I think the movie really would have benefited from adding in that sequence where he goes back home, because that's kind of where the whole point gets hammered home. You see him suffer on the front lines... only to come back home and everyone's full in on the propaganda, which he has that disconnect of, yeah, but like nothing you're hearing here is true or what it's like out there. And the movie really has none of that. You really only see him suffering on the front lines. So you get the war is hell thing, but you also don't really get the larger cultural context of what the book is trying to say about war and society. It's not just about the individual soldier on the front line. It's about people on the home front have this glorified view of war from the comfort of their own homes that they're not seeing. They're only hearing about it. So it's completely different. But the movie never gives you that.
And I think that was my biggest issue was that not only did it miss the mark, but it almost showed the complete opposite, where it does the war is hell a little bit, but it still kind of glorifies it. And the book is the total opposite of that. So I just felt like it was tonally completely different, especially the ending. I did appreciate that the ending kind of... The ending kind of mirrored the beginning. I'm trying not to spoil it, which I did like that portion, but the ending completely
turned the ending
shot
into
the other ending.
Yeah, without getting into the why of anything, the ending sort of made it... They sort of took the war is hell thing and turned it into a grand Hollywoodized spectacle, whereas the original book's ending was a lot more subdued, and that was the point. It wasn't a grand... It wasn't a grand finale. It was just sort of... The war was a waste of time, and nothing changed from it. The point wasn't, oh, grand send off and for the war and like big finale. Like that was completely contrary to the point where it was just like, yeah, all this fighting was just a waste of time. Whereas they made it meaningful in the movie, which takes away the meaning. It's ironic.
The book, the ending of the book made me cry. The ending of the movie just made me go, really?
Yeah.
I was so disappointed with the ending that I was just like, oh.
Yeah. All right. So now we're getting into stuff I just finished today. So I finished Wonder Woman, Lords and Liars by Mariko Tamaki, Mikhail Yanin, and Steve Pugh. This is a story about Maxwell Lord, who is... I really enjoy Maxwell Lord for what little I've seen of him, just because he's got such an interesting power set. He basically has the power of persuasion. He can mind control people or heavily influence them just by speaking to them. He's not a super tough guy. You know, he's very smart. He's got training, but that's what makes him a threat to someone like even Wonder Woman, is if she can hear him, she can be influenced by him. So even just being in his sphere is dangerous. So then you have somebody who's out to get him. And Maxwell Lord is sort of turning over a new leaf and deciding, hey, well, you know, maybe I want to do some, I want to use my powers for good. And Wonder Woman's like, well, fine. Who am I to shut down a potential redemption story? I'll help you out. I'll pal around with you for a while. So a lot of the book's just them bantering. But then somebody out there is out to kill Maxwell Lord. And Wonder Woman sort of has to protect him from this potential assassin. And the assassin's kind of annoying. I didn't really feel that character at all. I could see what they were going for with it, but it just didn't really work in the presentation of it. In terms of the art, I also liked the penciling, but the coloring was not to my taste. It was very, I guess, blended or something, and it was like very reddish, pinkish was very dominant as well. I didn't notice, there wasn't enough contrast in the colors for me, so it just looked like a lot of red and pink on the page, not a lot of being drawn out from the background. Contrast is really what I'm getting at here. It was too samey for me, coloring wise. But I did appreciate that the coloring sort of lended a dreamlike atmosphere to the thing, which is more prevalent later on in the story. It commentates on that, but the fact that it was there for most of the story before the ending makes me think that it was probably not intentional. But yeah, it was all right. If you turn your brain off, it's entertaining enough. This one was made to tie in to Wonder Woman 1984, where Maxwell Lord was the main villain of that movie. That's what I've read about it after the fact. So it's like, okay, well, here's why you're bringing him back now all of a sudden in this book. All right, I got one more on mine, so you do yours next.
Okay. So I watched War for the Planet of the Apes. I forgot how much I love these movies. I don't know why it took me so long to watch this one. I'm going to watch the... I just saw Kingdom. That the other one is on streaming right now. I'm going to watch that one as soon as I get a chance. But yeah, it's really good. It's just as good as I remember these movies being. They never disappoint me. And yeah.
It's a great finale for Caesar. The fourth one set really far in the future, but it doesn't matter. Caesar got his trilogy, did what he needed to do for his story, and got a good ending. So, if they messed up the rest, that's what I always said, is if they messed up the franchise after this, I don't care, because Caesar got a resolution. And it was handled well. So, you can just jump into Planet of the Apes there, if you want. If you want to go on the timeline. Andy Serkis was just incredible for all these movies. I still say the Planet of the Apes reboots are arguably the most underrated blockbusters of our time somehow. Nobody ever talks about them, but they're the most impressive visual effects I've seen in movies this last decade with the way they do their motion capture work and their post-apocalyptic environments. It's so engrossing and immersive. Especially when considering 90% of it's CGI and you don't really think twice about it. When Disney tries to do their live-action remakes, they're trying for something as good as that. But you never think about that on those. Planet of the Apes is basically a CGI movie that is just really good. Especially 2 and 3. Rise, not so much. But 2 and 3 are very effects-heavy. I'm probably overstating the effects on it, but what is there is brilliant for production design and mocap wise. This afternoon, I watched Dazed and Confused because I'm in another bout of stuff that's going to be leaving Netflix soon. So I'm like, fine, Netflix. You're forcing me to watch half my list at this point because it's all leaving within the month. Fine, watch Dazed and Confused. And I loved it. I didn't know. It didn't necessarily seem like the kind of movie that I'd be super into. But I'm very into the vibe of this coming-of-age teen comedy where I feel like a lot of people would hate it because nothing really happens in it. The entire thing is basically, it's 1976, last day of school. All the teenagers are excited to go to this party later. And it's basically just them just before school lets out, after school lets out, and for basically the whole rest of the evening is like, I don't even know how many characters were in it. There was like 6 to 10 main characters in it who all sort of bounced around for screen time. They hung out with each other for a little bit and then branched off into other things and sort of came together and split apart for a couple hours. But it was just fascinating the whole time because the whole thing was, it wasn't really about one specific plot or one specific character arc. It was sort of just the vibe of, we don't really know what we're doing. We're just going to see where the night takes us. And whatever shenanigans they get up to, it's basically a scene-by-scene basis at this point with arcs that crop up again throughout the movie. Everybody's got something going on or something motivating them for the night, but it's not, like, no one person's really the focus, I'd say. And it's pretty shocking how many soon-to-be famous people were in this movie. Just some of them. Matthew McConaughey is the famous one on this one. You know, this is where his all right phrase came from, was this movie. I think this was his first movie. Other people like Parker Posey, Ben Affleck, Mila Jovovich, Adam Goldberg, Anthony Rapp are some of the main characters in this movie. And I'm like, wow, most of you weren't really a thing back then. They were just teenagers at the time, I think. So it was impressive to see such a talented cast before they really came into their own. It's well paced, you know. Like sometimes on a Sunday like this, it was just we're filming on a Sunday. A lot of times I'm like, oh well, you know, I'll watch an hour with lunch and an hour with dinner, maybe whatever. I'll, you know, spread it out throughout the day if I don't feel like sitting around for 2 hours necessarily. But no, I just watched the whole thing all the way through this afternoon. I'm like, oh, I was just really engrossed in it. I didn't feel like getting up or doing anything else. I just sort of was taken along for the ride. It's well shot, well acted. I really like the dialogue. It's very naturalistic. Feels just like the conversations teenagers would actually have. Not melodramatic or by any stretch. It's just, you know, just teenagers hanging out. I also loved the philosophical conversation some of the nerds were having. Just like all the social groups felt distinctive, and their intermingling with each other was handled very smoothly. So that's the last on my list.
What you got? Okay, and the last one on my list was Percy Jackson and the Olympians. I watched the first season there. That's on Disney Plus. And this show, I wasn't expecting that much. I mean, I was a fan of the original run of books, and I was like, you know what? I'm gonna try it. It might not be aimed at me, but I'm gonna try it. I'm not sure who. This is another one where I'm not sure who it's aimed at, but the show was done well enough that I found it pretty entertaining. I liked it. I even thought it was good enough that I was like, oh, you should watch one episode. I made you watch an episode with me. And yeah, I happened to make good. You watch the... No, I made you watch the worst episode of the entire season somehow. It wasn't very representative of the show. But for the most part, it's pretty good considering you're dealing with three lead child actors. And they're not terrible. I mean, it's a little bit... Sometimes it seems like it's geared a little bit younger, but also it's still, the story still proceeds at a good rate. You know, it is based on a YA novel, so there's only so much you can expect from it. But I was pretty impressed with it. The filmmaking is done really well, and yeah, I'm pretty impressed, and I'm looking forward to see what they do for the next season.
You see, when you say you don't know who it's for, I don't know what Disney's going for with this show, because Percy Jackson isn't one of those things where I feel like is getting a new audience. I don't know if teenagers today are interested in the Percy Jackson show. Percy Jackson was a YA novel when we were kids. Those were the books that got me into mythology. That was sort of my first foray into Greek mythology specifically, but just mythology in general. It got me fascinated with that stuff at the right age. And I feel like a Percy Jackson show really only ought to be targeted at somebody our age, because older audiences wouldn't care. Younger audiences wouldn't care. It's really only for people in their mid-20s. But it's also seems to be presented like it would. It's for younger folks. So, I don't know. It's sort of a weird project for that reason.
Yeah, and I think that's just a result of it being based on a YA novel. They've tried to push it a little bit further while still retaining the age. Like, yeah, if a kid watched it, when the age that I was reading the books, if I was watching that show, I would be interested in it, right?
Yeah.
It's just finding that audience. I don't know if they'll be able to find it.
I mean, I wish them the best, especially if it's all right.
Yeah, it's pretty good, but you know, it's not so bad that it's like, I shouldn't say so bad. It's not so geared younger that you can't watch it. Like it's pretty well done that you can watch it, but you have to accept that it was like it's based off a YA novel. Like if you're our age and you did not read the books, I don't know if I would recommend watching it. But if you read the books, you'll probably enjoy it. Even if you didn't like, you know, even if you weren't like crazy about the books, but if you read the books, you'd probably enjoy it.
All right, that does it for another installment of Leisure Lists. All right, where can we find you?
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm and on YouTube at ThoughtPlane Media.
All right, you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. We hope to see you on the next Close Up with Ryan and Joe, and give Justin a big round of applause once again for being a great guest star. Till next time.
Take care.